KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Psychopath is a weighted, sometimes terrifying word. But psychologist Kevin Dutton makes the argument that not all psychopaths are violent. In fact, some of their qualities, fearlessness, confidence, charisma, set them up for success in today's society. Dutton is the author of The Wisdom of Psychopaths, What Saints, Spies, and Serial Killers Can Teach Us About Success. Dutton spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on October 30th, 2012.
Thanks, folks. Psychopaths pose a profound psychological paradox. On the one hand, they are ruthless. On the other hand, they are shameless. And on another hand, it's a good start, isn't it, three hands, they are actually capable of some fiendishly adaptive and curiously functional behavior. A doctor and a lawyer are attending a cocktail party together when the doctor is approached by a man seeking advice about his ulcer. The doctor mumbles some general words of incomprehensible medical wisdom, and then when the man has gone, turns to the lawyer and says, "You know what, I'm never quite sure how to handle situations like that where I'm asked for advice in public. Do you think it's appropriate to issue an invoice for one's services under such circumstances?" The lawyer nods enthusiastically. "Absolutely," he says, "I think it's perfectly acceptable." The next day, the doctor duly obliges and sends the man with the ulcer a bill. And the lawyer sends one to the doctor. Psychopaths, as I say, can be ruthless. A local charity suddenly realizes that they've never received a donation from the town's most prosperous CEO. So one day the chief fundraiser decides to call on him in person in his penthouse to see if she can get him to contribute. "Our records indicate that we don't seem to have you on our books at the moment," she intones. "You are a renowned public figure and the town's most successful businessman. We were wondering perhaps whether you might like to give a little something back to the community in some way." The CEO mulls this over for a moment and then smiles. "Do your records also show that my mother is fighting a losing battle with cancer," he asks, "and that her medical bills are currently several times her annual income?" I'm afraid not," mumbles the embarrassed charity worker. "I see," says the CEO. "That's okay. How about this? Do your records show that my brother, a disabled veteran, is blind and confined to a wheelchair?" No," mumbles the beleaguered rep. "I thought not," says the CEO, his voice rising in indignation. "Well, okay, let's try this then. Do your records show that my sister lost her husband in a car accident several years ago, leaving her penniless and with three children?" "I'm so sorry," whispers the horrified fundraiser. "I had absolutely no idea." The CEO shakes his head. "I'm sure you didn't," he yells. "So let me ask you this. If I don't give any money to them, why the hell should I give anything to you?" Psychopaths, as I say, can be shameless. But sometimes, just sometimes, psychopaths can get it right. An old Italian gentleman is living alone in New Jersey. He wants to dig his annual tomato garden, but unfortunately the work is difficult as the ground is rock hard. Sadly, his only son, Vincent, who usually helps him, is away serving time in prison, so the old man decides to write him a letter to explain his predicament. "Dear Vinny," he writes, "I'm a little bit down in the dumps at the moment because I want to dig my tomato garden this year, but unfortunately the ground is rock solid. You know what, I guess I'm just going to have to bite the bullet. I guess I'm just getting too old to be digging vegetable plots these days. I know that if you were here at home with me right now, my troubles would be at an end and that you'd dig the plot for me just like in the old days. But I reckon I'm just going to have to face facts. There'll be no tomato garden this year and I'm just going to have to soldier on alone. Love, Papa." Several days later, the old man receives a letter back from his son. "Dear Papa," it reads, "for God's sake, don't dig up that garden. That's where the bodies are buried." Sure enough, at 4 o'clock the next morning, a local police unit and an FBI SWAT team descends upon the old man's house and excavates the entire area. They find absolutely nothing, apologize to him profusely, and then leave. That same day, the old man receives another letter from his son. "Dear Papa," it says, "that was the best I could do under the circumstances. Now go right ahead and plant those tomatoes. I'm looking forward to some traditional, good old-fashioned home cooking when I get out. Love, Vinny." Deep in the neurobiological cosmos, the brain of the psychopath is glimpsed in remote orbit, a moonless world of glacial desolation and eerie mathematical charm. No sooner is the word out than images of mad reclusive bombers, one-eyed Taliban warlords, serial killers, rapists, Democrats, Republicans, and papists come scything across the badlands of your minds. But what if I were to paint you a different picture? What if I were to tell you that the arsonist who burns your house down might also, in a parallel universe, be the hero most likely to brave the flaming timbers of a crumbling, blazing building to seek out and drag out your loved ones? Or that the kid wielding a knife in the shadows at the back of a movie theatre might also, in years to come, be wielding a rather different kind of knife at the back of a rather different kind of theatre? Or that the supercooled financial assassin, the shadowy ambassador of charm whose mentholated morals and lightning sleight of mind robbed you blind of your entire life savings, might also, were he to put his mind to it, be the person most likely to save your business from going under. Claims like these, folks, stretch credulity to the limit, and yet they're true. Unlike their box office counterparts, not all psychopaths are violent. Far from it, in fact. Merciless and fearless, maybe, but violence is on a different neural freeway, one which sometimes has an interchange with psychopathy, but which just as often passes overhead. To see what I mean, take a look at the following simple grid. Let's start top right and work our way clockwise. Let's say that you are a psychopath, that you get a poor start in life, that you are low in intelligence, and that you are also dispositionally violent. To be perfectly honest with you, folks, your prospects aren't exactly that great. You're going to end up as a low-level thug or an enforcer in a criminal gang, something along those lines. Either way, you're going to wind up in prison pretty quickly. Remove violence from the equation, and your prospects are a little better. You're going to end up as a crook or a small-time con artist, a drug dealer or a hooker, or more likely than not, all four in combination. And again, you're going to wind up in prison pretty quickly. But now let's say that you are a psychopath, that you are not naturally violent, that you get a good start in life, and that you are intelligent. Now it's a different story altogether. Now, as the famous Reuters headline once put it, you're more likely going to make a killing in the market than anywhere else. Finally, let's say that you are a psychopath, intelligent and violent. Well, any number of exotic occupations might await you, anything from a special forces operative to the head of a criminal syndicate. To give you an idea of what I'm talking about, in 2011, I launched the Great British Psychopath Survey. Now, the survey is unique, the first of its kind to assess the prevalence of psychopathic traits within an entire national workforce. Participants were directed onto my website, where they completed something called the Levinson Self-Report Scale of Psychopathy and were then given their score. But that wasn't all. They also entered their employment details. What would turn out to be the UK's most psychopathic profession, I wondered, and for that matter, its least? Well, the results, as you can see, certainly make interesting reading, especially if you're partial to a sermon or two on a Sunday. The irony is plain as day. Guys like these, through some fiendish trick of nature, possess the very personality characteristics that the rest of us would die for. Indeed, that some who've fallen under the spell of the psychopath have died for. They possess immense poise under pressure, their refrigerated hearts barely skipping a beat under conditions of even the gravest danger. They are charming, charismatic, confident, ruthless and remorseless. So, having heard all that, do you think you might actually know one? Indeed, might you be one yourself? We're going to find out right now whether we do have any psychopaths in the house. I've got a little test here. So if you've got a pen or paper or if you've got your mobile phone or anything to keep a record of your scores, just fish that out for a moment. And we'll just run a simple little test, or you can do it in your head, but make sure that you add up your scores, okay? So, we have a simple scale at the top of the screen there, you see. 0 corresponds to strongly disagree, 1 to disagree, 2 to agree, and 3 to strongly agree. Now, there are 11 statements there, which I will read out to you. And your task is basically to assign a number to each one of them according to how well you think that statement describes you. Okay? So let's start with number 1. I rarely plan ahead. I am a spur-of-the-moment kind of person. Okay, so 0, strongly disagree, 1, disagree, 2, agree, and strongly agree. Number 2, no peeking here. Cheating on your partner is okay as long as you don't get caught. Number 3, if something better comes along, it's okay to cancel a long-standing appointment. Number 4, seeing an animal injured or in pain doesn't bother me in the slightest. Number 5, driving fast cars, riding roller coasters and skydiving appeals to me. Number 6, it doesn't matter to me if I have to step on others to get what I want. Number 7, I'm very persuasive. I have a talent for getting others to do what I want. Number 8, I'd be good in a dangerous job because then I can make my mind up quickly. Don't think too hard about that one. Number 9, I find it easy to keep it together when others are cracking under pressure. Number 10, if you're able to con someone, that's their problem. They deserve it. I think we've got a few psychos in the house, actually, folks. Number 11, last one. Most of the time, when things go wrong, it's someone else's fault, not mine. We've definitely got some psychos in the house, I think. Okay, so you should have 11 numbers on a page. Just put those to one side for a moment, and we'll come back to those a little bit later on, okay? Okay, folks, let's just get one thing straight right from the start, shall we? Being a psychopath, as we've just seen, doesn't automatically mean that you're a criminal. Not by default, at any rate. And it doesn't mean that you're a serial killer either. In fact, a heck of a lot of psychopaths aren't even prison. They're out there, if you remember number 7 from our survey, police officer, locking other people up. This may come as a surprise to many of you, but it's true. Rather like these scoring rings on a shooting target, there are, in fact, inner and outer zones of psychopathy, with only a tiny minority falling within the bullseye. Psychopathy is on a spectrum along which each of us have our place. And like any scale or dimension, it's going to have its A-listers. Now, the assumption that there exists a big fat dividing line between psychopath and non-psychopath is descended from the lineage of clinical diagnosis, more often than not within a forensic setting using standardized psychometric tests. The psychopathy checklist, for instance, is an established, well-validated questionnaire, originally developed by the Canadian psychologist Robert Hare for use exclusively within clinical settings and measures core psychopathic traits such as charm, persuasiveness, fearlessness, and the absence of conscience and empathy. On its 40-point scale, most normal members of the general population typically register around 1 or 2, whereas the entry level for psychopaths is generally considered to be 30. Now, within forensic settings, as indicated by their performance on the psychopathy checklist, hole-in-one psychopaths, as I call them, are way, way ahead at the top of the leaderboard. There is no question at all, a world of difference between these guys and the rest of us. But the problem, of course, is that not all of us live within clinical settings, and while Hannibal Lecter there is serving up liver for breakfast, the personality characteristics that separate out these what we might call pure psychopaths from the rest of us just so happen, like any other personality characteristic, to be evenly distributed across the general population as a whole. Just as there exists no official dividing line between someone who plays the piano and a concert pianist, for instance, or between someone who plays tennis and, say, a Rafa Nadal or a Roger Federer, so the frontier between a world-class psychopath and someone who merely psychopathizes is similarly blurred. Think about it. One individual, for example, might be ruthless, fearless, and demonstrate a sublime lack of empathy, but might at the same time act neither violently, antisocially, or without conscience. High on three psychopathic characteristics, such an individual might rightfully be considered further along the psychopathic spectrum than someone scoring low on those three traits, but wouldn't be anywhere near the danger zone of someone scoring high on all of them. Now, the assumption that there exists a big fat dividing line between psychopath and non-psychopath, as I said, is descended from the lineage of clinical diagnosis. But supporters of this dimensional take on psychopathy, that the core characteristics of the disorder are like the dials on a studio mixing desk, which may be twiddled up and down in various combinations, just like the clinicians, their own psychometric divining rod of choice, the Psychopathic Personality Inventory, or PPI. Originally developed by the American psychologist Scott Lilienfeld, the PPI represents a more nuanced detector of psychopathic traits, and in direct contrast to its predecessor, the psychopathy checklist, was designed for use within non-clinical settings, on you and I, for instance. Lilienfeld's monster test, the inventory, consists of a grand total of 187 questions, boasts eight dials on its own particular mixing desk, which you can see up there on the screen behind me. These eight independent satellite states of the psychopathic personality divide and reform along three superordinate axes: self-centered impulsivity, fearless dominance, and emotional detachment, to reveal a three-dimensional model of psychopathic space. But note, and this is pretty important, folks, that one's overall score on the PPI may be reached in different ways. Just as two athletes, for instance, might post the same overall score at the end of, say, a decathlon, for instance, yet exhibit completely different performance profiles over the course of the 10 events, so might two individuals post the same overall score on the PPI, have the same overall volume output level on the mixing desk, but output in different ways. Which means, of course, that we've got some fuzzy logic in the house. Because crank all of these dials up to max and have that as your default setting, and you overload the circuit. You wind up getting 30 years inside. But turn some of them up high and some of them up low, become, as it were, a method psychopath in the same way that you might be a method actor, and you'll be ripping it up in a different way to the Dahmers and Sutcliffes and Bundys. Which means, as I say, that we have a bit of a problem on our hands, a bit of a paradox. Because while on the one hand, we're unable to delineate the definitive psychopathic personality, what we are able to do, on the other hand, is flag up different psychopathic personalities. Think of it, if you like, in terms of national identity. Alaskans and Texans are both Americans, right? But is one more American than the other? On second thoughts, maybe don't answer that question. Okay. Which begs, of course, an even more fundamental question. Of these myriad psychopathic multiverses, might there actually be one with the optimal conditions for success?
Psychologist Kevin Dutton, the author of The Wisdom of Psychopaths: What Saints, Spies, and Serial Killers Can Teach Us About Success. Dutton spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on October 30th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Kevin Dutton in a moment. 826 949 KUOW. Islamist militants who kidnapped workers at a remote gas plant in Algeria say it's in response to France's intervention in Mali. Also, a chef divulges the recipe for one of his favorite meals from the cuisine of the province of Quebec. One Arizona Republican who became a Democrat over the issue of organizing a gun buyback. And Notre Dame's star linebacker mourning the death of a girlfriend who never existed. Listen for all these items tonight at 11. Weather outlook for the Seattle area for tonight, lows around 30. Mostly cloudy, areas of fog and freezing fog. Friday's prediction, highs around 40. Cloudy in the morning, becoming partly sunny. Areas of freezing fog in the morning. Patchy fog in the afternoon. Looking ahead to Friday night, lows around 30 again. Mostly cloudy in the evening, becoming partly cloudy. Areas of freezing fog. Saturday, more of the same. Highs around 40, partly sunny. Areas of freezing fog in the morning. Patchy fog in the afternoon.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Dr. Kevin Dutton is a research psychologist and the author of The Wisdom of Psychopaths, What Saints, Spies, and Serial Killers Can Teach Us About Success. Dutton spoke about his book at Seattle's Town Hall on October 30th, 2012.
The question of what it takes to succeed in a given profession is not, when it comes down to it, all that difficult. Alongside the specialized skill set necessary to do the job, there exists, from surgery to politics, from advocacy to IT, a constellation of traits which serve as a kind of psychological booster rocket. Business is no exception. And here it turns out certain psychopathic characteristics really do, it would seem, appear to come into their own. Several years ago, a team of psychologists from the University of Surrey conducted a bizarre experiment. They pitted a bunch of top business executives against a bunch of criminals from a maximum security unit on a test similar to the PPI that I was talking to you about a few moments ago, and compared their responses. What they discovered was extraordinary. A range of psychopathic characteristics were actually more common among the executives than the executioners. Where the executioners did come out on top was when it came to the more overtly antisocial manifestations of the disorder. Here, unsurprisingly, the executioners did come out on top, posting higher readings on criminal behavior and physical aggressiveness, and lower readings, respectively, on discipline and self-control. And that's not all. A recent study examining the personality profiles of so-called hero populations, those who work in law enforcement, the military, and the rescue services, for instance, paints a similar picture. Fearlessness, social dominance, and stress immunity dials are all turned up to the right, whereas antisocial, narcissism, and impulsivity dials are contrastingly turned to the left. Further evidence of the benefit of psychopathic characteristics in the boardroom comes from work carried out by the Canadian psychologist Bob Hare, who I mentioned to you just a few moments ago. Hare handed out his psychopathy checklist to over 200 top US business executives and compared the prevalence of psychopathic characteristics within the corporate community to that found within the general population as a whole. The results, folks, just not to put too fine a point on it, were certainly an eye-opener. Not only did the execs come out on top, but psychopathy was positively associated with in-house ratings of charisma and presentation style, in particular with creativity, good strategic thinking, and communication skill. And also, if the results of another recent study are anything to go by, with the ability not just to tolerate risk, but to thrive on it. Now, the study I'm talking about takes the form of a gambling game, consisting of 20 rounds. At the beginning of the game, each participant was handed a roll of $20 bills and was asked at the start of each new round whether they were prepared to risk the princely sum of $1 on the toss of a coin. A loss incurred the penalty of that $1 invested, whereas a win swelled the coffers by a cool $2.50. Now, it doesn't take a genius to work out the winning formula. Logically, as one of the authors of the study pointed out, the right thing to do is to invest in every round. But logic, as someone else once rather sagely pointed out, is often in the eye of the logician. Prior to the experiment, participants were divided up into two groups, those with lesions or damage to the emotion areas of their brains and those with lesions in other areas. If, as neuroeconomic theory suggests, it's an overdose of emotion that is responsible for unnecessary risk aversion, then according to the dynamics of the game, those participants with the relevant presenting pathology, in other words, those in the first group, should clean up. They should outperform those without. Surprise, surprise, that is exactly how the study panned out. As the game unfolded, normal participants began declining the opportunity to gamble, preferring instead to conserve their winnings. But participants with problems in their brains' emotional zip codes, participants whose brains were not equipped with the fittedest standard everyday emotional seatbelts that the rest of us take for granted, just kept on rolling and ended the game with a significantly greater profit margin than their competitors. This may be the first study, claims one of the authors, that documents a situation in which people with brain damage make better financial decisions than normal people. His colleague goes one better. Research needs to determine the circumstances in which emotions can be useful or disruptive, in which they can be a guide for human behaviour, he points out. The most successful stockbrokers might plausibly be termed functional psychopaths. Individuals who, on the one hand, are either more adept at controlling their emotions, or who, on the other, do not experience them to the same degree of intensity as others. Many CEOs, he adds rather unnervingly, and many top lawyers might also share this trait. Now, folks, in addition to making a killing in the market, of course, psychopaths have also been known to kill elsewhere. In 2009, 20 years after Ted Bundy's execution in Florida State Prison, a team of Canadian researchers decided to take this iciest of serial killers at his word. During interview, Bundy, who staved in the skulls of over 35 women over a four-year period during the mid-1970s, as I'm sure you're aware, confided to police that he could tell a good victim simply by the way she walked. "I'm the coldest son of a bitch you'll ever meet," Bundy once articulated, and no one could fault him there. But might he, the researchers wondered, also have been one of the shrewdest? To find out, they set up an ingenious experiment. First, they recruited 12 women, six of whom had suffered a previous traumatic attack, and six of whom hadn't. Secondly, they videotaped these women walking along a corridor. Thirdly, they then presented these 12 videotape segments to a group of students on the one hand and a group of psychopaths housed within the confines of a supermax prison on the other, and asked them quite simply to figure out who was who, which of the 12 women had been attacked and which hadn't. The rationale was simple. If Bundy's assertion held water and he really had been able to sniff out weakness from the way his victims walked, then the psychopath should be better at decoding vulnerability than the students. That, it turned out, was precisely what the study uncovered. Now, findings like these are no flash in the pan. In fact, this study is one of just a growing number that have in recent years begun to show the psychopath in a new, more complex light. A light completely different from the lurid shadows cast by newspaper headlines and Hollywood scriptwriters. An oddly, I guess you could call it an oddly adaptive kind of light. In the same year that the results of this experiment were published, for instance, I decided to perform my own take on it. If, as had been found, psychopaths really were better at zoning in on vulnerability, then there had to be applications. There had to be ways in which, rather than being a drain on society, it actually conferred some benefit. Enlightenment dawned when I was meeting a friend at the airport. We all get a little bit paranoid going through customs, I mused, even when we're perfectly innocent. But imagine how it would feel if we did have something to hide. 30 undergraduate students took part in my experiment, half of them scoring high on psychopathic characteristics and half of them scoring low. There were also 5 associates, or helpers, my evil co-conspirators, in the mix. The students' job was easy. They had to sit in a classroom, not unlike this one, and observe the associates' movements as they entered through one door and exited through another, traversing en route a small elevated stage. But that wasn't all. There was also a little catch. They also had to note who was guilty. Which of the 5 associates were concealing a scarlet handkerchief? Now, to raise the stakes and give them something to go on, the associate in question was handed £100. If the jury decided that they were the guilty party, if, when the votes were counted, they came out on top, then they had to give it back. But if, on the other hand, they got away with it, if the finger of suspicion fell more heavily on one of the others, then they would, in contrast, stand to be rewarded. They would instead get to keep the £100. £100 is a lot of money for a student back in the UK, by the way. The nerves were certainly jangling when the associates made their entrance. But which of the students would make the better customs officials? Would the psychopath's predatory instincts prove reliable, or would their nose for vulnerability let them down? When the results, folks, were absolutely extraordinary. 70% of the students scoring high in psychopathic characteristics correctly identified the handkerchief smuggling associate, compared to just 30% of the low scorers. Zeroing in on weakness may well be part of the serial killer's toolkit, but it can also come in handy at the airport. In fact, there's evidence to show that in addition to being better than the rest of us at zeroing in on subtle aspects of body language, psychopaths are actually more observant across the board and possess higher concentration levels in general than the wider population at large.
Psychologist Kevin Dutton, the author of The Wisdom of Psychopaths: What Saints, Spies, and Serial Killers Can Teach Us About Success. Dutton spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on October 30th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Kevin Dutton in a moment, 840, 94.9 KUOW. Americans at an oil facility in Algeria were among a number of people taken hostage yesterday. An Islamic militant group has claimed responsibility. A conversation about the crisis tonight at midnight. Visits to the front lines with people who are battling against time, or at least the commonly held concept of time. Einstein's theory of relativity may have implications on the concept of choice, namely that there is none. Do we choose what movie to see tonight? Some say no, it's already been chosen. Do we choose to wiggle our finger? Some say no, it's already wiggled. That's this week's Radio Lab, and you can hear it tomorrow evening at 7. Lows around 30 tonight for the Seattle area, mostly cloudy, areas of fog and freezing fog. Friday highs around 40. Cloudy in the morning with areas of freezing fog, becoming partly sunny. Patchy fog will persist, however, in the afternoon. Beck's latest music release, Song Reader, is simply a folder of sheet music, which he encourages fans to buy, arrange, and play themselves. Seattle pianist and band leader Wayne Horvitz talks about doing just that with members of Seattle's classical, jazz, and indie music scenes this weekend in Seattle. Hear about it right after the 9 o'clock news.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Dr. Kevin Dutton is a research psychologist who argues that we can learn from psychopaths. He's the author of the book, The Wisdom of Psychopaths: What Saints, Spies, and Serial Killers Can Teach Us About Success. Dutton spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on October 30th, 2012.
Okay, folks, I was telling you a few moments ago about the psychopath's finely tuned vulnerability antennae, about their enhanced killer instinct. But it might surprise you to know that there are some situations in which psychopaths are actually more adept at saving lives than they are at taking them. Let me give you an example of what I mean by that. Consider the following conundrum. Let's call it case one. A train is hurtling down a track. In its path, five people are trapped on the line and cannot escape. Fortunately, you have a switch which you can flick, diverting the train down a fork in that track, away from the five people, but at a price. There is another person trapped down that fork, and the train will kill them instead. Question: should you flick the switch? Now, most people, folks, have no trouble deciding what to do under these circumstances, though the thought of flicking the switch isn't exactly a nice one. The utilitarian choice, killing just the one person instead of the five, represents the least worst option, okay? But now let's consider the following variation, case two. As before, a train is speeding out of control down a track towards five people. But this time, you are standing behind a very large stranger on a footbridge above the track. The only way to save the people is to heave the stranger over. His considerable bulk will block the train, okay, although he will fall to a certain death, saving five lives. Question: should you push him? Now, folks, we've got what we might call a real dilemma on our hands. Though the score in lives is precisely the same as in the first scenario, 5-1, one's choice of action appears far trickier. But why should this be? Well, the reason, it turns out, all boils down to temperature. Case one represents what we might call... Case one represents what we might call an impersonal moral dilemma. It involves those areas of the brain, the prefrontal cortex and the posterior parietal cortex, in particular the anterior parasingulate cortex, the temporal pole and the superior temporal sulcus, primarily responsible for what we call cold empathy, for reasoning and rational thought. Case two, on the other hand, represents what we might call a personal dilemma. It involves the emotion area of the brain, known as the amygdala, the circuitry of hot empathy, the feeling of feeling what another person is feeling. Now, psychopaths, just like most normal members of the general population, have absolutely no problem whatsoever with case one. They are perfectly happy to flick the switch, diverting the train accordingly, and killing just the one person instead of the five. Ouch. But, and here is where the plot thickens, quite unlike most normal members of the population, psychopaths also experience little difficulty with case two. Psychopaths, without a moment's hesitation, are perfectly happy to chuck the fat guy over the rails, if that's what the doctor orders. Ouch. Moreover, this difference in behaviour has a distinct neural signature. The pattern of brain activation in both psychopaths and normal people is identical on the presentation of impersonal moral dilemmas, case one, but radically different when things start to get a bit more personal, case two. Imagine, for instance, if I were to hook you up to a brain scanner, a functional magnetic resonance imaging machine, and were to present you with these two dilemmas. What would I see as you went about trying to solve them? Well, at the precise moment that the nature of the dilemma switched from personal, impersonal to personal, from case one to case two, I would notice the emotion area of your brains, your amygdala, and related brain circuits, your medial orbitofrontal cortex, for example, light up like a pinball machine. I would witness the moment, in other words, when emotion puts its money in the slot. But in psychopaths, I would see nothing. The cavernous neural casino would remain in darkness, and the passage from impersonal to personal would slip by unnoticed. And I'm not just talking, in case you're wondering, folks, I'm not just talking about functional or successful psychopaths here. Several years ago, now, I presented a variation of this dilemma to a psychopathic killer, one of our hole-in-one psychopaths who we were talking about earlier, who back in the UK had raped, tortured, mutilated, and eventually ended up murdering, in particularly brutal fashion, a young woman back in the 1980s. Parts of her anatomy, in fact, were later found in the glove compartment of his car. I'll never forget this guy, actually. He was better looking than Brad Pitt, and more significantly, perhaps, he had an IQ of 160. I'm going to read you out now the particular variation of the dilemma that I gave him, and then I'll read you out verbatim, give or take a few words, his response to it. Okay? So think about what you would do in this situation. Similar to the train problem, but a little bit different context. A brilliant transplant surgeon has five patients. Each of the patients is in need of a different organ, and each of them will die without that organ. Unfortunately, there are no organs currently available to perform any of the transplants. A healthy young traveller, just passing through, comes into the doctor's surgery for a routine checkup. While performing the checkup, the doctor discovers that his organs are compatible with all five of his dying patients. Suppose further that were the young man to disappear, no one would suspect the doctor. Would the doctor be right to kill the young man to save his five patients? Okay, see the similar score here, five lives against one. This is what the psychopathic killer said. I can see where the problem lies. If all you're doing is simply playing the numbers game, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? You kill the guy and save the other five. It's utilitarianism on crack. But it's not that easy, is it? There's a difference between letting someone die and actually killing them, isn't there? If the doctor did nothing, he'd be letting five die. And if you ask me, so what? But to save them, he actually has to roll his sleeves up, doesn't he? Get blood on his hands. He has to commit a murder, a different ball game altogether. He has to be proactive. The trick's not to think about it too much. Imagine if you'd just bought a new £1,000 suit and saw a child drowning in the river. Would you jump in and save them? Of course you would. You wouldn't think twice about your suit. You'd just do it. So, why not go straight out there now and donate £1,000 to some kid's charity in Africa? I'll tell you why. Because all of a sudden you have to think about it. You have to think about whether you can afford it or where the money's really going. Some warlord's pocket, maybe? I'm cutting out the bad language here, by the way. If I was the doctor, I wouldn't give it a second thought. It's five for the price of one, isn't it? Five bits of good news? I mean, what about the families of these guys against one piece of bad? That's got to be a bargain, hasn't it? Okay, folks, I'm running just slightly over time. I was going to talk to you about something which I'm a paper I'm writing at the moment called The Psychopath Manifesto, which is the self-help version of the book, about how we can all psychopath up in everyday lives to make ourselves a little bit more successful. I'm going to have to skip over that now. I'm going to pick study people. One of the things that psychopaths we know, so psychopaths are extreme social predators, and they are constantly surveying us to see whether what they do, their actions or their words, to see what impact they're having on us. And there's evidence to suggest that because of this, psychopaths are actually much better at telling apart truth-tellers from liars. Okay? Now, the reason we think this is the case is because when we tell a lie, okay, our brains download something called micro-expressions on the muscles of our face. These are lightning changes in facial scenery that our brain, as I say, downloads onto the muscles of our face before it decides the real public picture that it wants the world to see. And we think that psychopaths, because they are studying us so intently, they're able to pick up on these micro-expressions to some extent, which to most of us, most of our perception is are invisible to the naked eye. Interestingly, I've just come back from northern India, where I've run an experiment on another group of people who are also extremely good at picking up on micro expressions, and these are expert meditator Buddhist monks who live high above the snow line in the Himalayas, and they can, in a different way to the psychopath, they can, through years and years of compassionate meditation, can slow their perception down, and so pick out these micro expressions as well. At least that's what we think is going on. The experiment I ran, and I'm going to give you a couple of examples now just to round off, to see whether psychopaths were better than Buddhist monks at this test of cold reading ability, I decided to call the experiment Punks versus Monks, although I'm not sure I'll actually be able to get away and publish that under that title. What I did, I presented them with 20 pleader videos. Now, pleader videos are those videos that you get, you see on the television, little clips, usually organised by police press conferences, where you get people who are appealing to the general public for information about their lost loved ones, you know, children or spouses or whatever. You understand what I'm talking about? Okay. Now, we know that some of these guys have done the deed themselves, and we know that, obviously, a lot of them are genuine pleaders. So I got 20 of these pleading videos, and I presented them to a bunch of Buddhist monks in caves in the Himalayas, and we will be presenting them to a bunch of psychopaths as well, and it's a very simple test. We're going to see who is able to discern who are the truth tellers and who are the liars. There's 10 true, 10 false. Okay. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to present you with three of these, okay, and we're going to see if anyone can get three out of three of these, okay? So I want someone to call out a random number between 1 and 20. 14? Okay. 14. Okay. Genuine
or false? I would
like
to just ask if there is anyone in the public who might have any information, no matter how small, that may be able to help the police.
Okay, folks, I want to show of hands. How many people think that guy is a genuine pleader telling the truth? Not many. Keep your hand up. Come on, have the courage of your conviction. Okay, come on, put your hands up. Okay, not too many. Okay, hands up. How many people think he's telling a lie? Well, you're absolutely right. That guy is actually telling a lie. He has done the deed himself. Okay, so a lot of you got one out of one. Give me a number, another random number between 1 and 20, not 14.
7.
That was pretty decisive, wasn't it? 7. Okay. Same thing again, folks.
But kids want you back. Kids need you back. I need you back. Please get in touch. Please let us know where she is. planned the best birthday that you've ever had. The kids have made banners for you, cards for you, and you'll love them. Please come home.
Okay, who thinks he's telling the truth? Gee, you're a suspicious bunch, aren't you? Okay, a few more than before. Who thinks he's telling a lie? You're right, he's telling a lie. Wow, who's got 2 out of 2? Who's got 2 out of 2? About a third of you, okay. All right, one more. We're going to do one more, then we're going to finish. Random number between 1 and 20?
2.
Okay. Okay, oh, okay. Here we go. Last one.
Somebody somewhere knows who did this. My husband, Eric, did not deserve this. As a frail man, any resistance he put up could easily have been overcome by these two young men.
Okay, folks, how many people think she's telling the truth? Okay. Oh, God, how heartless. How many people think she's telling a lie? Okay. She is telling a lie. She is a very wicked old woman. Okay, let's just have a final show of hands, folks. How many people got all 3 out of 3 there? Not too many. What did you score on that psychopath test? Low?
Average,
all right. Okay, anyone score low on it and got all 3? Well, there's always one, isn't there? Okay, folks, I'm going to leave it there. Thanks very much for turning out tonight. What I'll just say is some of you were probably thinking, am I really a psychopath? Some of you are probably thinking, is my best friend a psychopath? My bank manager a psychopath? My spouse or partner a psychopath? Obviously, there is no better way than finding out than to buy this book, which I shall be shamelessly signing later. But thanks for coming out on a pretty grim old night tonight. Thank you.
Psychologist Kevin Dutton, the author of The Wisdom of Psychopaths, What Saints, Spies, and Serial Killers Can Teach Us About Success. Dutton spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on October 30th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Repertory Theater, presenting American Buffalo, David Mamet's tough-talking, dark comedy about a plan to steal a valuable coin collection. Playing January 11th through February 3rd. Tickets at seattlerep.org. 859-949 KUOW-FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Tomorrow evening, we're going to hear a program on the theme Too Much Information, in which David Weinberger from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society tells why he thinks knowledge lies in the links between data and information. We'll also hear the case for books in the face of all the digital data available. Web watcher David Siegel tells why he thinks the web's too data heavy. He says the solution is to stop duplicating and make all that data, particularly our personal data, more meaningful.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.